It looks like somebody is actually using the power switch in front of the server to turn it off while we're active and working.
Yeah. And, Hugo, wait. Does this story involve a video camera?
Yes, it does.
This is the story, Alex. What? This is the story I wanted to tell that I heard. And I wanted to name this episode, if we use this story, I wanted to name the episode End Job Abnormal. Hugo, please keep telling this story. I can't believe that you know this story. Oh, this is awesome. Okay.
Welcome to You, Me, and IBMI.
So, Kurt, I know you've got an interest in IBM history and IBMI AS400 history in particular. So I found this morning's meeting very interesting, that there's going to be some renovations to the local history center that will involve IBM. Are you thinking about getting in on that effort? Because I know you've got materials that could be put to good use in a historical center.
You know, that's true. I do. And actually, before this podcast, I just went over and dropped off a large box of 8x10 glossy photos of old pictures of IBM and the products and the people that used to work here to one of the site coordinator people. So, it'll be nice to, if I can be a small part of that effort, that'd be nice. I don't think they need me. But it is nice. There's a lot of artifacts that are around here from the history, the rich history we've had.
Half of them on your desk.
Half of them on my desk or in areas I kind of co-manage.
And if I'd known you were going to give those away, I would have had a closer look at those photographs. But I guess I lost my chance.
We can go get them off her desk. Actually, I thought I had one in here, but there was a picture. I thought it kind of looked like someone who used to work in Account Advocate. So I kept that up for her and I'll probably go back and grab a couple that I like. I took a couple,
all right.
But, that you bring up a good point. IBM Rochester and the IBM Global Support Center does have a rich history, and I think it's kind of interesting. Could be interesting to customers to learn more about that history. We could have maybe we can have an episode where we specifically talk about some of that history sometime. But yeah, I think some of the best, I think some of the best history though is the people that work here. You and I have worked here for a long time. Some of the people we work with and look up to, they worked here for a long time. And today our guest, Hugo Castillo, has also worked here for a long time, but I don't think I've ever met Hugo. Hugo, are you on the line?
Yes, I'm here. Hello.
Hey, Hugo, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you.
How long have you been working for IBM?
This is my second tour with IBM here.
It is.
Yeah, and this time around, it's since 2006, so it's about 18 years, I think it's going to be this year. And my first run with IBM was about 10 years. About a year and a half, 2 years that I ended up working with a business partner.
Okay.
And then I came back. So, most of my life has been working with IBM.
So when did you start at IBM? And because you don't live in Minnesota, have you ever lived in Minnesota?
I did get married in Minnesota and went to school in Minnesota.
Oh, you did?
I did, up in the Twin Cities. And I did, that's where I, got my first job. And finished school, got married in Minnesota. I have two kids that were born in Minnesota. So we lived there for about 10 years, 12 years maybe.
Was that during your first stint at IBM that you lived in?
No, that was before that.
Minnesota?
That was before that. But it was my first job while still in college. I was hired to replace System 36.
Now, what does that mean? When you say you're hired to replace System 36, what does that mean?
The college that I was still going at, and I was working for the computer lab, or labs. They, you know, I started as an intern, I guess, and then they hired me to do their IT out there. And
sure.
They used to teach the Office products in the System 36. I don't know if you guys remember that.
A little bit, yeah. That's some old stuff.
And the idea was to replace that System 36 with, you know, a local area network. And we put, you know, Office. I don't know if it was Office. I think it was WorkPerfect, if you guys remember that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Lotus. And so that was my first job. And for all of it, I shared my office with the System 36. It was really loud. But yeah,
I was going to say, how's your hearing these days?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, it was interesting enough. That's what, ironically, I was starting to know IBM. It started with me trying to replace a system, which they did. But yeah. When we finished that, a place in St. Cloud, Minnesota, heard about my. My role in designing this local area network with the college, and they were sure. interested, and they had the same idea. They wanted to, take their office vision, and this time they ran on an AS400 back then, and the idea was again to create a local area network that had, that they could do email on it. My second job was in St. Cloud, Minnesota. To replace an AS, not the AS400 itself, because they probably still use it. It's still a customer okay. allows, as far as I know. But the idea was to take the Office part of it, the email out of it, and put it into a local.
Oh, area. Sure.
Right.
Kind of modernize that yep. so that exactly. people use new tools.
Yep. And that's where I, I finally got to meet the AS400 back then, and I kind of, I got in touch, got to use it, and of course I really enjoyed working with it, and you could say I fell in love with it. So it got me in touch with the AS400. I got to know it. Worked there for about 2 years or so. Then the drive was pretty bad.
From Minneapolis to St. Cloud.
To St. Cloud every day. Yeah.
Oh my God.
I know.
Yeah, that's Highway 94, right?
Yeah. And I got hired by. And another company, you guys probably heard of this one company. It used to be pretty big back in the 90s. It was called, and I think I can say it no longer exists. It was called Tidal Wave. It was like a big blockbuster that had, both music and you can rent, take videos home and buy music.
Sure.
And they had this superstore concept. So it was, it was like big stores that had everything in it. And they had lots of stores in the Twin Cities. I don't know if they ever had one in Rochester, but they definitely had some, 13, 14 stores up there. So it was pretty interesting. And their main system was an AS400. And that's when I got okay. to finally be the administrator for it, not just the user hired to replace it, but the administrator. And that's when I got my experience with the AS400.
And did you run into any work? Because you're on the work management team.
Correct.
And I imagine administrators are oftentimes having to deal with work management issues. So
yeah.
I guess that's what got you interested in work management?
Yeah, exactly. And, it's the day-to-day operations that you do, right? They're part of what I do in work management nowadays, right? So, creating users, securing the system, which is important.
All right,
And that's where it got me started. And, in the system itself as an operator, as an administrator. But that's not why I ended up in work management, I guess, in this case. And here's where, my life with IBM started. And it turns out that, we as a family made a choice to go back to the country that I was born in, which is in Bolivia, South America.
Oh, Bolivia. Okay.
We worked, after school, and we had two kids already, and we said, why don't you, let's see if we can, if we can go down there and see how it goes for a little bit. And we did. And I got back down there, and after a few attempts or jobs, I got a call from the IBM general manager back then, which was a friend of an uncle of mine. He said, "Hey, I need somebody to do a systems engineer." That's what they were called back then, and it was, you know, our role that we do. But back then, as a system engineer, you got to go to clients. You know, they called, and you just walked and, you know, took a taxi or whatever and drove to their offices. And you did, all the work on site.
That's
right. Yeah. And it was for software, too. You know, we still have the hardware people that do that. But in back then, it was software that we did. And the manager said, "Hey, my guy that was doing this quit. And, you know, this was Thursday, I think. And he says, I need you on Monday. Can you do it?" I was like, sure. I just need to, you know, I really wanted this job with IBM. And
this is still in Bolivia, right?
This was in Bolivia, right.
Okay.
And so that was back in, I'm not even sure when, 94, I think. And so that's when my role with, my first 10 years with IBM started, with IBM Bolivia. And I started as a system engineer for the AS400. There was just one of us there. And of course, that's when I got to meet, you know, second level support, and which was in Argentina, which is still, you know, we still have some team members from there.
Well, hold on. Wait, no. You just said something that's interesting.
Yeah.
You said you're a systems engineer and there was just one of us there. Do you mean that there was one IBM systems engineer in Bolivia?
For the AS400. Yep. And I,
wow.
I got to hire the second one. We're growing.
Was that the day after you started? Like, I need one more person so I can take a day off.
I think it was a while afterwards, but, yeah, we didn't have that many customers. We still have a lot. I don't say lots, but we still have a presence in Bolivia with AS400, IBM I now and our servers. So
Hugo, what brought you back to the States?
Yeah, so we always talked with my wife about coming back. We always had, in Bolivia we had two more kids, so they were a total of four at that point. And they were growing up and we always wanted our, you know, kids to come to school here and get back to, you know, where we were here before. So that's back in 2004 or 2006, I think, is when we decided to come back. Okay. And that's when I got my my job with IBM here at Rochester.
Hugo, did you and your wife meet in college?
No, we did not. And this is another story. My wife is from Honduras in Central America. And I met her while I was on vacation in Honduras for summer break. My dad worked for USAID. I think it's pretty in the news a lot lately.
It's a very good program.
Yeah. And he was living in Honduras and I got to go visit him for the summer. And that's where I met my wife. And we married in Minnesota, out there. And so, yeah. Yeah, we've been all over the place. We picked up and moved ourselves many times.
I would think that would be challenging with kids. I mean,
yeah.
How did your kids comment on it now? Like, why did we move around so much?
Yeah, of course, they never, you know, when we decided to move back up here, they didn't want to come here at all. They were like, I'm going to lose all my friends and you guys, don't like us anymore. And you know how that goes. And they never wanted to come back. And, but, you know, after a while now, you know, if we ask them, it's like they don't want to leave. It's like, it was kind of hard at first, but they got used to it and really like it here. And I'm in the Cincinnati area now.
You are?
Yeah. But I did go up there and worked at the support center for a while. And I did move. Back in 2007, I think, I was up there on the white buildings, I think.
We were all there up then. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Since you've been in the support center working here, Have you been in the same area of work management kind of the whole time?
I have. I was hired, and I was hired for work management. I didn't know it back then, but when I was interviewing, they were interviewing two positions, one's for advanced support and one's for work management.
Okay.
I did end up on the work management area, which I really do enjoy it a lot. You know, back then I didn't know it, but it turns out that I got, you know, for the position that I really wanted, which is work management and security.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
If you were forced to choose any other queue to work in here in the IGSC,
yeah,
what would you choose?
Interesting. If any. Well, you know that for a while they had us combined into the OS team, I think it was called, where we combined both Save Restore and Work Management, right? I think you guys remember that.
That's right.
Yeah, so we got to learn everything from Save Restore to BRMS and tape and all that fun stuff that Kurt has to do nowadays. So, and I did enjoy that for a while. I don't think I remember much of it now, but it was fun. I would stick with work management if I had a choice.
Well, you're like an administrator. It's probably the closest to an administrator as you can get here in the IGSC, I would guess.
Well, work management really touches so many areas that I would think that over the years you would have ran into certain situations and kind of interesting customer cases. I know for myself, I have some of my most memorable, you know, interesting cases. Like I'll never forget customers that, you know, sang to me about after their issue was resolved and I kept their voicemail messages, you know, and just silly things like that. Do you have any favorite or kind of most memorable cases you've had over the years?
Yeah. So I was thinking about it since you mentioned something. I did want to share a story that's a real life story, something that did happen to me. It wasn't at the support center here, but it did touch our developers in the support center.
Sure.
And I think it highlights one of the things that that we at work management and security area we talk a lot about, and that's securing your system. So I did want to share it. It started back to when I was that system engineer and visiting customers and talking to them. You get to talk to a lot of the customers because you're there and you're spending a lot of time with them, right?
Yeah,
and it turns out that I'm really good at explaining technology.
Actually, I was talking to Tina a little bit earlier today about things, and I said, "Is there anything that I might think to ask Hugo about?" And that was what she said. She said, "Actually, Hugo trains a lot of the new people on our team in security and, you know, how to use these things and make sure things are working properly." And she said, everyone always reports that the way he educates the rest of the team about how to handle cases and do work is just top notch. So that's you saying that, it's interesting that that's the one thing she mentioned is how good you are about training other people.
It turns out that because of the way I explain technology to people, I got, you know, as a software engineer, I got some of the bigger sales back in those days with the IBM customers. You know, one day I was talking to them, to a customer, and their printer was kind of slow. And I said, well, you know what? IBM makes really nice big printer, industrial printers, and you should, you know, look into it. And she's like, what? You guys do printers and industrials? And like, it was a big financial customer. And they say, well, let's look into it. And I went back to IBM. I said, these guys are interested in this big printers that we have. And they, you know, and I, in IBM Bolivia, nobody knew anything about it. And it's like, what? We don't have anybody that does this. Why don't you find out and, you know, get a quote and give it to the customer? So I did. I presented them to, you know, a proposal. And this is as a system engineer, nothing to do with sales.
Yeah.
And it turns out that, you know, this big printer, you probably heard about them when you're printing days. It was an IBM 3900, I think.
Okay.
And big laser printer, and I don't know, it sold, and it was like, you know, $600,000. So it was a big sale for IBM, especially for IBM Bolivia. And, you know, I did it without even being a salesperson.
Yeah.
And, you know, 6 months later, they, you know, other customers heard about it, that printer, and they wanted a big one that it was also a laser color printer, and they wanted to do books, and somebody shows up in IBM and, you know, talks to me because I was the printing expert back then. I was like, here comes the second printer. This is more expensive. And so, you know, as a systems engineer, I had two of the biggest sales for the year for IBM. And it's like, you know, so this general manager took notice and he goes, you know, I'm going to put you in sales. You know, you're doing great in this. I have no complaints. But, you know, in IBM, we definitely want those sales. And they put me in sales. I started as a, what would they call it, a hardware support engineer, kind of, you know, doing the sales. But after a little bit, I was put as a customer representative, which, you know, you're the main contact with customers and they talk to you about everything. And of course, because I was starting, and here's where the story comes in. I'm sorry, I took a little bit there introducing or getting to it, but you know, they first assign you the worst customers, right?
Now, what does that mean, the worst customers?
Yeah, I should say customers that haven't bought from IBM.
Oh, okay.
Or never, or they're, you know, customers that are the competition.
Sure.
Or we know the customer is there. We know they have a chance that, you know, they definitely buy technology, but they haven't bought it from IBM.
The challenging customers.
Yeah. So customers for the competition and not for us. So I did get this big bank, which was, you know, a big, you know, a financial institution in Bolivia. One of the bigger ones there, but it was never an IBM customer. And
okay.
And that's how, when you first start, you get assigned those customers, of course, until you prove yourself, right?
Sure.
And, you know, here comes a year and a half, and I heard that this big customer was looking to replace their main system, which included both hardware and software.
Hardware and software, but also they needed a printer, right?
I don't think we sold them a printer, but
that's just a $600,000 down the drain there, Hugo.
Yeah,
oh,
I know.
Okay.
Not this one. But anyhow, we did some presentations. I got to get people in there talking about the IBM Power servers. And here's where, you know, the link to IBM Rochester comes in. And of course we, you know, provided them with a proposal with, you know, power servers and all the, you know, it was a cluster of servers and storage and all this stuff that comes with it. And we fought really hard for that opportunity. And turns out that, you know, after a while we won it. IBM won this, you know, this opportunity, this big banking new customer. It was, you know, I think 1.4 million. It was, you know, it was a lot of money. And especially...
Yeah.
It was money that, you know, didn't go to a competitor. So it was a really good thing.
Yeah.
Celebrations, we did great. And, you know, customer placed the order, you know, about 6 months probably after that. You know, of course, we received equipment. You know, they installed it. They were testing it. They had to migrate, you know, their current banking system. So it wasn't something that was right away.
Sure.
But let's say about 6 months later, we hear back from the customer saying, hey, we're planning on going live next week, and we want you guys to be, you know, informed, heads up, you know, this is what we're going to be doing. And be prepared just in case. They hadn't had any problems with the servers at all, but, you know, be prepared. We're doing this. Here comes, you know, Monday, customer switches to the new system, turn it on. Everything is working fine. Hear back from the customer and say, you know, everything's good. Transactions were, you know, optimal. Everything's working fine. This is great. Here comes Tuesday. We get a call from the customer saying the server crashed at 11 a.m. in the morning. This is our busiest time of the day. It crashed in the middle of everything. And of course, we want answers. And it's like, oops. So let's get people, you know, in there. Yeah, I wasn't a software engineer back then already anymore. So they went, you know, they started looking, they started collecting data. Of course, we opened up a case with here with Rochester. People asked for debugging data and things we sent, and, you know, we're still investigating. Meantime, you know, the server did come back up immediately. So it was, you know, an outage of,
okay,
you know, not very long. They just restarted the server and everything was working fine.
Okay.
Here comes a couple of more days and everything's working fine. And that server crashes again. Oh. And of course, sentiment in the customers is rising. There's, you know, what's going on here. And as soon as we have people in there, the thing's crashing and this is not good. Of course, we, you know, back then we had, and I think we still do, those critical situations, the crit state, you know, it became this, it's a very divine
sure.
crit state. Everybody was involved. And I'm not going to make it that long, but I think it was one more crash. And until we, you know, one of the developers in here from Rochester goes, you know what? All the data that we're collecting, everything that we have, looks to us that someone is using the delay power off option. It looks like somebody is actually using the power switch in front of the server to turn it off while we're active and working.
Yeah. And Hugo, yeah. Wait, does this story involve a video camera?
Yes, it does.
This is the story, Alex.
What?
This is the story I wanted to tell that I heard, and I wanted to name this episode, if we use this story, I wanted to name the episode End Job Abnormal. Hugo, please keep telling this story. I can't believe that you know this story. Oh, this is awesome.
Okay. Well, so the developer kind of mentions it. It kind of looks to us that someone is turning off the server while we're functioning, and you know they're doing a delay power off, and that came back to us. I remember that the general manager and I, general manager for IBM, believe, and I, you know, asked for a meeting with the president of the bank, and we said our developers think somebody is turning off the server, and we recommend that you keep an eye. And immediately he says we're going to put a camera on the server room. And you know, 2 days, and they did this at night, put the camera without anybody
okay.
knowing. 2 days later or something like that, that server went down again. They went back and reviewed the data in the camera, and they found that the system administrator, the guy that was the administrator for the previous system, which was, of course, administrator for the new system now, was, you know, getting to the mm-hmm. front panel and turning off the server while it was working. He was always opposed to IBM winning the, you know, getting in there. He was for the other, I guess, competition. And because they didn't
sure.
pick them, they wanted to make, you know, the IBM servers look bad by crashing them forcefully during the day. And
yeah.
And of course, he was doing that. They caught him. Police was involved. Of course, immediately they fired him. But there was, you know, they took him to court. And I don't remember what the outcome was. But yeah, he did confess to what he was doing. And he, you know, of course, he had done it the two previous or three previous times. So it brings us, you know, the ingenuity that, you know, that our, you know, developers have. And they said, you know, they recognized this as something that was, you know, done by somebody and not
right.
by the servers not being there. We actually got a better relationship with the customer after we told them that, because, you know, they trusted us a lot more after that.
And hopefully the system ran fine after they stopped flipping the switch.
Never had problems anymore.
I heard this story from a guy that used to work here named Mike Chasko.
Okay.
And the other part of that story was that a few months later, another customer called in with a similar issue, that it was randomly, the system was randomly powering off, and that Mike or somebody from that team overheard someone discussing this, went over and grabbed the phone from the guy who was talking to this customer and said the name of that previous guy and said, hey, does so-and-so work there? And the person said, yeah, we hired him last month.
It's funny that you've heard of this story. And this was a long time ago, but it's a real story. And it highlights that the fact that security, and this is where I kind of wanted to, you know, bring it up to point. It's not just the, you know, keep your password safe, but, you know, you definitely need security, you know, secure your server room, which is important.
Yeah, physical security.
It falls under security and it falls under, you know, that area that we're under.
But Hugo, what took you away from sales back to tech support? I mean, isn't the commission that you get from sales more remunerative?
It definitely is. IBM had plans to change their go-to-market strategy in a lot of the South American countries. So they were no longer having an office with an IBM or organization in it and relying on business partners. We had to go look for, you know, other, you know, opportunities around there. And
okay.
A business partner of IBM in Central America kind of got word of this, and they offered me a job in Guatemala. And that's where we made our second move to go to live in Guatemala for about a couple of years or 3 years in there. It's not the same as IBM. So I always wanted to first come back to the technology side of it. I wanted to come back to the role of, supports engineer and not sales as much. Even though I was very successful with it, and I did enjoy it.
I'm sure your communication skills that you developed, well, maybe you had those skills before you were in sales, but you have to have awesome communication skills in sales. And I'm sure your current customers appreciate that when you're trying to explain a difficult topic to them.
I hope they do. Yeah, definitely come in handy.
Alex, did you ever work in sales? Have a sales job, Alex?
I have not. No, I've been in support the whole time. And, you know, sometimes I wonder what it would be like to work in any other area doing anything else. And I'm a little bit jealous of Hugo's varied experiences.
I don't mean at IBM. I used to be a door-to-door salesman for water treatment systems. And I would go door-to-door selling. I'm not going to name the place, but it's a very large water purification company in the United States. I was very bad at that job. I like to consider myself I can talk to people, but I was horrible at that job. So I knew after that, I never wanted to work in sales because I just couldn't.
Yeah.
Part of me wishes I'd tried it at some point, but I'd never have. And I don't think I ever will.
Yeah, technology sales with IBM is different than other areas. You really like, it's a really nice place to work. It was, I don't, you know, I'm sure it still is, but selling for IBM is a nice experience to have.
So Hugo, just to kind of come around, circle back to something, you know, with this customer that, this particular user, right, ended his own job, his actual job abnormally. Yeah. Alex and I have been talking a lot recently about the end job abnormal command. And specifically, I know we reached out to you last year at one point before the podcast was even a thing to talk about, you know, how do you kind of recommend running this? Because you're just a total leader when it comes to work management and jobs and things like that. And what's your experience with that? Because we do have a lot of customers that know about this command, that run this command and kind of get themselves into trouble.
Yes, you're right. Let's talk about the end job abnormal command. Before we can, though, we have to talk about what end job does, or what we call the end of job processing. And this happens to every single job in the system, right? A job gets started, it creates some temporary structures, it creates, you know, it's library information, it opens things, and you know, it runs, and you know, when it's done, all jobs in the system are going to end, right? This end of job process that we go, it's important that we understand what happens there And then we can talk about what the Java normal does or actually doesn't do and why it's, you know, its use is probably not, it's not something that you should take lightly. You should definitely consider before using it. But okay, when a job ends or this termination phase starts, the system has the task to clean up everything the job has done when it started and it ran and it worked. So a lot of things like we close database files if we have any database files open. We close other types of files, you know, display files or, you know, data queues or any other object that we had been using during this life cycle of this job. All of those are closed and, you know, those resources are released because we're going to have certain types of logs against this object, right? We're going to put a lock on a database file so that we can update it or change it or do anything with it. We need to release those logs, well, you know, so that somebody else can use them.
Okay. And these can be both shared and exclusive logs on objects.
Correct.
Okay.
And a lot of the things that we're doing here are either to both share resources or to resources for which the job has the, you know, it's the only one that has access to. For example, library Qtemp. Qtemp library is something that we create for every job. It's its own individual library. It's a temporary library, but it contains objects that are, you know, permanent in nature, meaning that they are there, they exist, they're clean, but they still occupy space and they're there, right?
What do you mean that they're clean?
When this job completes, part of that end of job processing clears that Qtemp library, right?
Gotcha. So they're cleaned up.
Correct. They are.
Sure. Well, so but you said that each job has its own kind of...
its own Qtemp library. Nobody can see anybody else's Qtemp.
Oh, interesting. I did not know that.
You can't look into somebody else's Qtemp. We can get some information from it by dumping or, you know, servicing a job. But in reality, every job has its own individual Qtemp library that gets cleared when the job ends. A couple more things that happen when that job is ended. If the job is under commitment control, if we need to roll back any changes, we're going to do that. We're going to call a lot of our message handler to set things like message queues back to their default delivery methods. That way, you know, they can be reused if needed. And we're going to produce a job log, right? That's when a job log gets produced. Remember that, you know, that message login that we asked about, that all takes effect when that job is ending. That's when we copy the contents of that job message queue and we put it in a job log spool file. And so that happens during that end of job processing as well.
Okay. Yep.
We then clear that job message queue as well. Job message queue is known as the job log. That's where all of the messages are placed in the job. You know, then they're cleared and put into a job log when we're, you know, when we end. We do allow jobs to remain in the job log pending status. So that means that that job message queue can stay active if that job is set to do that.
That's through a job log server.
It can be through a job log server. It can be by the job itself. But yeah. You know, we can just say, hey, go ahead and end and don't produce one. Keep it available out there. So that's what happens when a job ends normally. Even if it ends up normally with an error message or a function check or anything, we're still going to go through that termination phase.
Cleaning stuff up.
Here's where the end job and normal comes in. And here's where it's kind of, you know, that's what we're saying, don't use it. If somebody uses the end job abnormal against this job, it's going to prevent this job or it's not going to let this job do all of these things that I just talked about. So it's not going to release all those logs that we have. It's not going to produce those job logs that we have. It's not going to go through the cleanup process that we did. It's not going to clear up those message queues, release those logs that we have, release those resources that we have. And that can definitely cause problems, right? One example that we see a lot and we used to see a lot is, for example, if I use an end job abnormal against a save job, a job that was placing lots of logs on a lot of objects in the system, right? You know, we place 30,000 logs on 30,000 files so that we can, you know, save them. without anybody else touching them.
That would be part of, if you're doing a save job and you're doing like a save while active, we would go out and we would have to get locks on all kinds of stuff, like everything in a particular library, especially if you use the option to say, you know, to save everything in a one library, kind of a checkpoint, you know, and then we grab all the locks. Once we finally have them, or we've have 90% of them, and we've given up on 10% because we can't get locks on those. Then at the one point, you might have 30,000 locks, or at least a shared lock on all these objects.
And that's where, if I use the end job abnormal and this job is not allowed to close or release those locks, well, they're going to be left you know, unlocked, right? And I know from working with Alex and his team that we sometimes see, hey, this object is locked, nobody can touch it. But when we do a work object lock on it, or display, you know, lock status, or use some of those APIs to display locks and IFS objects, you know, they look like somebody still has a lock on it. And that's that job that ended up normally, that never released locks on those, you know, on those objects or resources, right? The problem now is that because we didn't let the job do it, we used that job abnormal command. Well, the only way to release those locks, as an example, is to IPL the system, right? And so just because we use the end job abnormal on one job, we now have to, you know, IPL the entire system to be able to able to use those you know, those objects again. So that's one of the you know, possible scenarios where, you know, the job abnormal command is not something that you should have used.
Well, and that will automatically set the abnormal IPL flag so that your next IPL will be abnormal. Alex has told me about that before.
Yeah, so that's one of the things that we do every time you use the end job abnormal. The system is going to say, hey, by the way, you ended, you know, things abnormally. We may have not released all those locks, and all those resources are not clean, like that queue temp still out there. Well, on that next IPL, let's clean it. So we're going to mark that IPL as an abnormal so that the system goes into that IPL and it's aware that we're going to be doing that extra cleaning, right? And we're going to call an additional set of programs while that IPL is coming up, that do all that cleaning for jobs that ended abnormally.
Say I'm an administrator and I've got a job that wasn't giving me the output that I wanted. And so I attempted to end it. It does not end. What should I do instead of jumping to end job abnormal?
So first thing is never attempt to use, you know, the end the subsystem where that job is running under, to make it end abruptly, meaning that, you know, ending the substance is actually going to make things worse. That is that it's not going to force that job that's having trouble ending and any faster because you decided to end the subsystem, which is running under. If the job is in trouble already, ending the subsystem is not going to make it that trouble go away. It's still going to have whatever it was affecting it in the first place, still going to affect it. But now you have a subsystem that, you know, is now in an end status as well, and it's not going to accept any new jobs. You know, never end the subsystem thinking that's going to help. It's what, you know, if you can take out of this podcast, you know, I said to do, don't attempt to do that. It's not going to help.
We'll put that in this episode's description, Kurt.
The other thing is that you cannot use the end job abnormal command after you have waited 10 minutes since you issued the end job immediate. So you're still going to give him some time to do that.
Why do you have to wait 10 minutes?
10 minutes because we the system says, well, you know, let's let that job call those invocation handlers, those processes that, you know, close things up. Let's see if that job can do it on its own. And because if we're not going to do that, you know, we're definitely going to get, you know, can get ourselves in trouble. And we certainly will do that. So there's a time limit that we put out there before you can use it. But then you can use it, and you're allowed to use it, right? As long as you have enough authority to the command, you're certainly going to be able to do it.
You mean to run NJob abnormal if you actually want to?
So the thing is, and this is what we call, sometimes it may be hard for a customer to realize that, and they may have to open up a call with us, because we have tools that we can look in the customer system to say, yeah, in this case, hey, go ahead and use that NJob abnormal command, and you're not going to get in any more trouble than, you know, because you're using it. That's, you know, and it should end the job, because we see that, you know, this is what's happening with this job. This is what's preventing us from ending right now. And it's safe to use it. But in the same thing, we may say, hey, no, this is not a good idea to use the end job abnormal command, because right now this job is, you know, in a situation where data integrity could be, we could affect it. We could, we could left things that are not stable, I think is what we call it, or unstable resources, I think is what, you know, what our developers use. But it could leave this or the system in a state where we don't, we're not functioning. As a matter of fact, the other thing that it does is, if we use the NJob abnormal command, and then you call IBM and you say, hey, tell me what was wrong with this job. Well, just because you use that NJob abnormal command against the job, it may have changed the initial problem, the call stacks and things that this was job was hang on and couldn't end, to something else. So now the collection of data is not correct because we use the NJob abnormal and it's changed. So it's also one of those things that, sure, you know, maybe they want to, you know, they're in a hurry, they don't want to waste, you know, or open up a case and talk to us. But it's definitely something that they should do. You know, if the job is doing, it's under commitment control, it's doing a rollback, and job abnormal is not going to help. And it's actually going to make things worse.
And it's going to prevent root cause analysis.
Exactly.
So you recommend, if people are in the situation, they not run NJob abnormal, you recommend they run NJob star immediate, wait 10 minutes, and then basically during that time, probably open up a ticket to the IBM I Global Support Center, try to find someone that knows that area. But here's one question I have that kind of is in this. So eventually, though, you may have to tell the customer, yeah, you know, one, probably you want to collect service docs.
Right.
Before you do that. But then also, you may be telling the customer, well, yeah, it's safe to run NJob normal at this time.
Yes.
One thing I'm confused about is, what's the difference between the way NJob abnormal works and how an IPL would work? If somebody issued power down sys star delay, say 10 minutes or something like that, what's the difference between how that works? Yeah. And how NJob abnormal works.
So an NJob abnormal, like we said, it's not going to go through any of those cleanups that processes job termination phase that a regular NJob goes through, right? So none of those things that were open are going to get cleaned. Logs are going to be left unlocked. You know, we're not going to produce a job log. We're not going to clean that queue temp. So that's just because we use that NJob abnormal. And those need to be cleaned on an IPL.
What is an IPL doing if someone IPLs the system instead of running NJob abnormal? Yeah, I'm looking for, what's that difference?
In actuality, there isn't. And that's something that we see sometimes when we have a job that it's not ending. The customer doesn't do an NJob abnormal. They just say, I'm going to IPL the system right now, right? I'm going to force an IPL. That's going to end the job. And it does. When that IPL runs into that issue, it's going to find out that there's a job out there that is in trouble. It's not ending.
Okay.
And I know that there's, you know, our developers thought about this because they got a couple of system values that affect how we're going to behave when that happens. And one of them is how long we wait before we abnormally end that job, then it's not ending. So we're going to put a timer out there and we're going to say, okay, job, I'm going to let you, give you some time before I force an end to you. And we kick up the timer. By default is 900 seconds, 15 minutes. And we're going to wait and see if that job ends. in a lot of cases, because it wasn't ending before and you issued end job immediate a long time ago, it's not ending. When that time, when that time expires, we're going to do the same that an end job abnormal does. We're going to end that job abnormally. And of course, we're doing it as part of an IPL. That IPL, again, will be marked abnormal because we ended jobs abnormally. They're going to show up in your history log as in job, ended abnormally. We know this a lot of times when customers say, hey, we were unable to reach restricted state. We can go and take a look at the history log and see which jobs were ended abnormally by the system. And by then we can say, hey, the system had to end this job abnormally, which is the same that an end job abnormal would have done, or even more forceful. And the IPL, again, is where all that cleanup occurs. So it would occur even, if you used the end job abnormal or if you didn't, because we ended those jobs abnormally, we're still going to do that abnormal cleanup that we have to go through during the IPL.
Well, I feel a lot more knowledgeable about the IPL process and end job abnormal now.
But we had some time to talk about it.
What are some things that you're working on these days that you're looking forward to more customers finding out about?
Yeah. So I think this is already public. It's been publicly announced, but 7.6, you're right, it's in beta now and customers are using it. One of the big, big things here is, and this is a big change for everyone, is the ability for the system to do multi-factor authentication.
Yes.
And that's going to be part of the operating system. Doesn't require that you purchase any additional functions or products or LPPs or nothing like that.
It's not $600,000?
No, it's part of it. And the beauty of it is that it works without any communication between the client and the server. And I think that's one of the greatest things that this technology brings in, because both the server and the client are going to be able to come up with that same token, same number in your authenticator app that the server is going to come up, and there doesn't need to be any communication link active between that server and, your phone.
But the clocks will have to be in sync, right?
That's the only thing that matters, is that we have both the client and the server have the same key, which, of course, you create when you create your profile for that. And then the times have to be in sync, right? And that's important. But we can do that. That's, something that we know how to do. And both the server and the client calculate that same token. And if you enter it, and it's the time synchronized, we don't need to talk to each other.
First time I saw something like that, somebody in the center was active and doing a little bit of day trading. And I can't remember if it was through E-Trade or one of the other ones, but they had this special token that was, I think they had it on kind of like a clip that was, might have even been in their wallet or something, but they pulled it out and you could see, it was like maybe kind of like a thick credit card. And they could see that number, that code on there would change about every 15 or 20 seconds.
Right.
And then that's how they were able to log in and do that two-factor authentication. This is probably back in like 2005 or something like that. So really,
it's been around a while.
That's exciting that that's going to be coming to the IBM i. And hey, if we have customers that have trouble with that in the future, we're going to have you on again, man.
Great.
Thanks for joining us, Hugo. It was really interesting to hear your career history and that crazy story about the system getting turned off. And
and the next time you come up here, Alex will buy you a beer.
There you go.
Just absolutely great to have you on the podcast today. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us here on
You,
Me,
and IBM i.